Last week, Stephen Harper introduced his first majority budget. Despite a promise to raise retirement age, eliminating nearly 20,000 jobs, and the curtailment of environmental assessments, last week, the Winnipeg Free Press praised Harper's 2012 budget as a budget for most Canadians. Canadians are being told we must get used to expecting less from government because of global competition and changing demographics, even if that means a reduced standard of living for many. A similar story is being told in many other countries. Most dramatically in Greece, European banks have imposed a series of austerity measures, including reductions in benefits, frozen wages, increased sales taxes, and the elimination of protections against layoffs. Joining me to talk about austerity budgets and their effects in Canada and around the world is Radhika Desai, political scientist from the University of Manitoba. Welcome, Radhika.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So the term austerity has been used to describe this budget, Stephen Harper's recent budget, but the term has been having a resurgence in popularity in recent years. Can you maybe talk a little bit to help unpack that term? What's meant by austerity and why is it being used now?
I think there is, I read somewhere a while back that apparently the Merriam-Webster dictionary had named austerity the word of the year in, I think, 2009 or 10 or something like that. Clearly, it's been bandied about a great deal. The main reason, from my point of view, the way I look at it, I think that it is simply the latest form that marketist anti-state politics policies or ideologies are taking. Now, don't get me wrong. Anti-state and marketist policies or the state policies have not been anti-state as far as capitalists are concerned. The state has quite happily stepped into the breach, for example, in the most recent financial crisis and has tended to put through a number of pro-capital policies. But it is the state is to be restricted from doing anything which is in the interest of either labor or working people generally and the vast majority of the people. So in that sense, we got neoliberalism in the 1980s, we got globalization in the 1990s. We even got empire, which was in a very oblique sort of way, but definitely another type of marketist policy in the sense that we were told that America is tops and everybody should emulate America and so on. And that meant, of course, small government and so on. Anyhow, the point is that austerity is just the latest form that these policies are taking. And the general idea is to have a set of government policies in which basically a further installment pro-capital policies in which they are taxed less, regulation is made more easier and easier for them, as we see in this budget, for example, the process for environmental approval of a variety of projects has been scaled down. At the same time, there are a whole range of policies that are going to make things harder for labor, and of course services will be cut back practically all across the board. All governments spending departments will be facing cuts. So basically austerity is just the latest word for it. And why do you need a new word? Quite frankly, because all the policies that have been justified under the previous or all the three previous labels have actually become discredited as a result of the financial crisis. So we now have a new label, but it is in that sense just old wine in new bottles.
So one of the key platforms in this budget is the increase of retirement age from 65 to 67, and it's being reported as a necessary adjustment because of Canada's changing demographics. Is Canada's aging workforce imposing a fiscal crisis on the Canadian government, as Harper suggested?
Well, actually, as we know, there have already been a number of authoritative sources, including the Parliamentary Budget Officer, who have actually denied that this is the case. Our retirement funding system is not, a pension system is not in crisis. I think in order to put the budget in perspective, I think we should take a couple of steps back. First of all, everybody everybody was just so relieved that we did not have a sort of slash and burn budget, that we are not looking at the extent to which this budget is a budget for capital. It is not. I think you were quite right to point out that the Winnipeg Free Press's judgment that it's somehow a budget for all Canadians must be questioned. It is absolutely not so. In fact, what you see here is that not only is it a budget for capital and against labor, but even within the capitalist class, it is a budget for Western capital in Canada, that is to say Western Canadian capital. In a very real sense, it is about the it's about creating an economy which is going to export raw resources. Capitalists in Western Canada will become extremely rich on the basis of it, and there will be a small amount of spin-offs from that. But So in that sense, basically, it's a Western Canadian capitalist's budget. So I think that's even worse than having a sort of more broadly Canadian capitalist budget, if you see what I mean. I'm being partially ironic, but manufacturing industry in Ontario and Quebec is really going to suffer. They're already suffering. And of course, Jim Flaherty has been berating the Ontario government for not doing even more, effectively not cutting back even more, where in fact the cutbacks will simply slow down the Ontario economy even more. Let me say one other thing about austerity, which really joins austerity and our budget in a closer way. Basically, austerity is justified on the basis of the need to pay off debts. I mean, now, there are many things to be said about this. But first, let's just say that imagine that, okay, we do have debts to pay off. There are, in fact, two quite different ways of paying off debt. And only one of these is being pursued under by austerity policies. And it is the one that is guaranteed. It is the one which is ultimately a very short-term one. So the one way of cutting the debt and paying off the debt is to constrain consumption. If you as a family owe money, you can pay it off in two ways. One is you can cut back on your consumption. The other is you can earn more money. In order to earn more money, you have to invest. You have to create earning capabilities. So there is... And that, so for a country, that would involve the government actually expanding its expenditure to ensure that Canada becomes capable in manufacturing, in processing the wealth of raw materials that Canada is sitting on, etc., in doing all of these things and increasing the capacity of Canadians to earn money both and make themselves happier, more prosperous, more secure, and able to pay their way for those things they need from the rest of the world. At the end of the day, it's very simple. That's what we need. But this is what the government is not preparing Canadians to do, because again, to create an economy which is going to rely even more on exporting raw resources is a step backwards to the economic stone age. I mean, let me just give you one example. I was teaching my class the other day, and one of the things we ended up pointing out, because it was a factoid that came up in the readings, is that there is only one of the more amazing facts about recent world economic history is that Argentina is a country that went from being extremely prosperous at the end of the Second World War, its per capita income was as great as that of the advanced industrial world, to basically where it is today, into third world country. It has sort of fallen two notches or something. And its principal reason for that is that it never seriously industrialized. And I think industry is very, very critical. We all dislike, environmentally destructive industry, but there is no inherent reason that industry needs to be environmentally destructive. Indeed, the present crisis is a perfect opportunity for governments to expand, to spend on creating environmental industries, to create industries that will produce environmental products, that would produce more environmentally friendly versions of existing products, etc., etc. So there's the range of opportunity for expanding our economy is tremendous. But in fact, we are being told that the only agency that is going to be allowed to create wealth is the private sector. And you know what? Since the 1970s, private sectors throughout the advanced industrial world have not exactly distinguished themselves by creating growth. They have typically created growth only under the boost provided for a time for one country, for a time for another country by low exchange rates. And so at the moment, for example, the United States seems to be posting something of a bit of a recovery. It's not huge, but why? Because the dollar is declining. So in that sense, I think that they're experiencing that boost. And I think that to wait around for the private sector to grow when Canadians, through their democratically elected institutions of government at all levels, can be doing a lot more to govern their economic fate. I mean, it's a no-brainer. I don't see why we should do it unless you have an agenda. And of course, the Harper government's agenda, as I pointed out, is about creating an economy, not just for capital, for Western capital. Yeah. It's terrible.
So you talk about this wedge between Western capital and manufacturing capital. One of the things I've noticed as well is that there may be an attempt to drive a wedge between generations. And I just read a quote from Finance Minister Jim Flaherty, told CBC recently, "We need to review everything, look at it all, and make sure that for younger generations, as they grow older, those social programs will be there for them and they can rest assured that they're sustainable." What do you think about this this juxtaposition of this really weird use of sustainability in my mind, but also this generation wedge that's attempted to be drawn here?
I think certainly the government, I mean, let me take again one step back. I mean, I completely agree with you that the government is certainly engaging in the sort of rhetoric which is intended to pit one generation against another, make young people feel that somehow the older ones have had it too good, and that they must, on the other hand, not only accept that they will have less, but also resent the older generation because they somehow had it good. No, in fact, we know that the Canadian pension system is not in crisis. And indeed, many analysts are pointing out that precisely when this government projects the problem to occur, in a sense, is precisely when the pressure, insofar as there is demographic pressure on the system, it will begin to ease. So, I mean, I think we all have to look at the figures before, I mean, not accept the government's analysis of this. But I think there is also another agenda at stake in the retirement issue. I think that increasing the age at which Canadians can retire has to do with some people have already recognized that it has to do with the labor market. And so I heard somebody on the radio saying the other day that basically it's about ensuring that our demographic deficit, that is to say that somehow we have fewer workers than we need, will be fulfilled because we will have more people forced to work until a later age, and therefore the paucity of younger people will be partially rectified in this respect. But I think it's about labor markets, but in a slightly different way, and in fact in a radically different way. It's basically about, as we live longer and longer, if we were all had the option to retire, then supposing I reached the age of 65, decided, okay, I don't want to work full time, but I will definitely want to work part time. After all, it gives my life meaning, I enjoy it, etc. I will become the type of worker who will not be afraid of her employer in the same way as someone who has a family to feed, etc. Will be. So I think that basically it will create a workforce, an important section of which will not be afraid of the sack. That's what the government does not want. That's the sort of labor market policy this is. And I think that, in fact, before this government came along and started doing this, I used to say that increasingly we will have important sections of the workforce that are like that. But clearly this government knows it too, and it does not want to go there.
And the specter of old age poverty is certainly a disciplinary force for younger generations as well.
Exactly. And of course, the other part of it is that insofar as the message to young people is that they must save and save and save for their retirement, it is completely contrary to what, what in fact, the world economy needs. In fact, we need a pension system in which existing workers are, you have to think about all the equity issues, but existing workers support existing dependents, whether they are too young or too old or too sick or what have you. The idea that we all must save actually constrains world demand, which has been a problem throughout the world economy since the 1970s, in fact, because we have been implementing these neoliberal policies, which have cut back on government expenditures and so on. So the point I want to make is that increasing savings by these people will simply constrain demand even more. Look at it this way. China, despite all expectations that its dependence on U.S. Exports to the U.S. would mean that after the 2008 crisis, its economy would begin shrinking, it has not happened. In fact, China has continued growing. Why? Because the Chinese government has expanded domestic demand drastically. And so if you look at the growing parts of the world, that's what's happening. They are the ones who are not implementing austerity policies. And what's more, they are the parts of the world that are not exclusively reliant on the private sector to create growth.
So one other area I find really interesting is that in the 1930s and 40s, Canada had much larger relative deficits and debts than it does today. And yet that was the era when we started talking about pension systems, unemployment benefits, healthcare, and these kinds of programs. Why is it that we're seeing the opposite reaction to deficits today?
Just a small point. I think you mean the 40s and 50s, because that's when we had, after the war, the high rate of indebtedness, but still the state spent in order to create these welfare systems and so on, which you're quite right that that's what happened. The answer is simply this. At that time, working people were much more mobilized to demand these things. And I think that, and in fact, capitalism was at a very, very low ebb. I mean, just look at it this way. In the 1930s, not only did capitalism suffer a Great Depression, not only did fascism emerge in capitalist lands, by contrast, the Soviet economy grew throughout the 1930s. And a lot of Western intellectuals were quite impressed with that. And so, and of course, also remember that in order to win the war, all Western governments, all capitalist governments had to implement the type of more or less complete complete control, state control over the economy, which was equated with socialism. So in a sense, the West during those decades actually saved capitalism by taking many leaves out of the book of socialism. Today, however, we are being told, and I think these ideologies must be contested, that somehow socialism was all bad, that it never achieved anything, that we are better off without it. No, actually, I think we need to re-examine those experiences in order to correct our understanding of what they were. Not everything about them were good. Certainly the lack of political freedoms and democracies was not good. But a lot of those regimes provided a lot of things which we today, which would make our society today much better. So I think that we need to re-examine them in a fresh way and not believe the sorts of ideologies that are being sold to us, because it really blocks us from imagining futures in the open and free way that we need to imagine our future. Because again, that will be a central part of resisting these sorts of policies, which is desperately needed. I mean, the Occupy Wall Street movement has been a great start, but it's only a start. We need to create a resistance. And on top of that, then we need to create an alternative or a set of alternatives.
Well, thanks so much for sharing these ideas with us today, Radhika.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Radhika Desai. Radhika is a professor of political science and an editor for the Pluto Press book series, The Future of Capitalism.